Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning or good noon, ladies and gentlemen. If you're in the East, it's good noon. And out here in the West, in the Rocky Mountains, it's good morning. We'd like to welcome you to broadcast number two with Jeff and Jameen. This is an offshoot of Gold Radio Cafe with Bosco. Bosco is still involved and still is gracious enough to send us along information. We've been spending the week gathering up information and noodling on what next to broach and also what to carry on from our last show to our next show. Good morning, Jameen.
Good morning, Jeff, and good morning to all of you out there listening. I just wanted to add that we are now online, so you can visit our website. It is retooling.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter, which is @retoolingdot.org. So we will be tweeting links from our show throughout the show, and definitely visit us online.
All right, well, we're going to dive right in. We will always keep the thread of gold in our venue, and we will always keep the thread of the retooling. As one of our friends pitched up, let's dial things back in and not get things too complicated. And let's also stick to various topics, which for Jameen and I will be extraordinarily difficult. However, as we've pointed out this week, we're going to talk about privacy. We're going to talk about gold. We're going to talk about mainstream media in Forbes.com actually talking about gold in a spiritual bent, which I want to first address in how we're doing it.
Well, I thought that was really interesting. We were sent an article actually from Bosco from Forbes.com, and it's an article talking about how gold is a spiritual substance. And it's interesting to see the mainstream media taking on this perspective, especially after that's what we talked about in our show last week.
It was happenstance, purely coincidental.
Tell us about this article, Jeff.
Okay, well, this article is written by a guy named Harry Binswager, who knows. And it was put forward, Bosco wrote, here we have an article that actually speaks to some of the things that we were discussing last week, as Jameen brought up, the vibratory realm of gold. So we're going to dive in there for a moment. And we talk about Harry's predisposition towards the financial industry, and some people in the financial industry, as Bosco and I were wont to talk about, make reference to gold or denigrate gold by saying you can't eat it. Well, you can't eat dollar bills either, and you can't eat bond certificates. So there's a very interesting predisposition about it that's a bit scary. And we will have another conversation with another guy on our show. We'll bring in a guest talking about why gold is so important.
Well, what you're talking about is intrinsic value. Is that what you're saying? And in terms of currencies and things that we value or we use as currencies, whether or not they have an actual intrinsic value. And gold does have an intrinsic value, whereas something like Bitcoin, for example, does not have an intrinsic value.
Great point. Great point economically. And I'm going to start to quote from Harry's article. And he's got, an aspect of gold is its unique purity. Okay, purity both in its color and in its incorruptibility, which is what Jameen was just saying. In a world that features decay along with growth, degeneration along with the too rare improvement, the imperishable radiant luster of gold offers a sense of unfailing reliability and stainless consistency. Wow. The guy actually talks like he listens to us, or rather we talk like we're listening to him. No,
well, you know what? It is the age of telepathy, in a sense, that we're all on the same page a lot more than we used to be. That's we've got this interweb of sorts, so who knows where we're all pulling ideas from.
That's great. So he makes reference to John Maynard Keynes, and because Keynes had, as Ben Bernanke did a little while ago, making a declaration that gold is not money, Keynes made a reference to gold being a barbarous relic, which Harry and I and Jameen and Bosco take great deference to, or filthy lucre, which is how the preachers play that hand. But an object aesthetic value whose meaning has roots in the nature of how our minds work and the need for incorruptible moral integrity. There is an an aspect of our history where we speak of golden ages. And we would like to think that we are in the midst of losing an old age where greed and selfishness are imploding or blowing themselves up, and we are going to step into a place where we are collaborative, collective, and cooperative.
So this reminds me of this cartoon that I once saw regarding gold and why it has such high intrinsic value. And I don't remember where I saw it. Hopefully it will, if I remember where I saw it, I will put it on our blog. But what it did was it actually went through the periodic table of elements and it subtracted all of the things that you couldn't use as currency, such as gases, such as liquids, such as items that were, such as items that are harmful. So things that if you touch it, it's going to make your hand fall off. And then it also subtracted the items which were overabundant. And then it subtracted the items which were too rare. And what it came down to were that the two elements left on the periodic table were gold and silver. And so, I don't know, that just reminded me of that.
And that's from one of our friends, Brent Johnson at Santiago Capital, who writes these wonderful things. And we'll do what we have. We've already reached out, and we'll see if we can bring him in. And I think there has to be something said about one of the things about the ancient history, the ancient cultures that is obvious because everybody knew about it, is they used gold as a means of exchange. But they also used gold in ornamentation and gold everywhere. The Aztecs, the Mayans, the Egyptians, the Greeks, everyone. And so consequently, there has to be some validity in that it's been in our recorded history. It's always been an important scenario, right?
So back to Harry.
Back to Harry. Okay. Quoting again, gold jewelry is fully as objective a value as utilitarian goods such as bread or automobiles. These goods provide value by being consumed, by being used up. You eat bread and it's gone. You drive a car and it wears out. Gold is almost unique in being an unconsumable consumable. Like Aristotle's unmoved mover, gold provides value without being itself affected. Very important aspect, right? And this whole, the context of you can't eat gold inverts gold's significance. Gold is extra valuable because you can't use it up. Gold, as we just said, as we just read, was an unconsumable consumable, and it does not have to be replenished. It also is not so abundant that it devalues itself.
Exactly.
The gold jewelry of ancient Egypt still retains its value today. Because gold is, like a Rembrandt, an object of contemplation, it is used without being used up. Okay, and that all of this explains why gold has a monetary value. Because gold is of imperishable objective value, it conserves a store of value. And given that base, which Bitcoin lacks, as Jameen just pointed out, gold's other inherent properties make it uniquely suited to serve as a medium of exchange. Unlike salt, gold has a high unit value. Unlike iron, gold does not rust. Unlike diamonds, gold can be easily divided into very small pieces without losing its value. And unlike a computer chip, gold is homogeneous. And because it's ductile and malleable, it is easily reshaped. Gold has aesthetic value, and as men's free choice demonstrates, monetary value. And you would think, perhaps, in the past times, in the times of the Golden Age, which are ruled by wise sages, we would like to think, or certainly it's been represented, there is reason behind gold being used as a monetary system, as a monetary unit.
And are you referring to that reason as a spiritual vibratory reason?
Well, exactly. And I'm going to read you another little quote from one of the individuals whom we think very highly of in the writings on a great master named Saint Germain. And this is
so. Before you read that, for the when you say a great master, how would you explain that to someone who has no idea about esoteric philosophies, is not particularly religious, and might well call you a crackpot for referring to some great master? What does that mean?
Great point. Great question. Let's chat about the wise sages who wandered around the planet. Let's chat about Mahatma Gandhi. Let's chat about an old Asian sage called Lao Tzu. Let's chat about Confucius, who actually wrote a bunch of stuff down. Let's chat about Zoroaster, who was a Magian, Master. Let's chat about the three wise men. The three wise men have been named in various iterations. They've been named Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. They have been named Dwalkul, Kuthumi, and Moria. Saint Germain has been written about for hundreds and hundreds of years in contemporary literature, and he is one of the ascended masters whom, to many, has been giving guidance and direction to mankind for a long time.
So you just used the word iterations, and so for someone who has no idea what that is, what is an iteration? Many countless iterations.
Oh, good point. Okay, so we would suspect, and we may cover this in a future show, but we would suspect that part of our conversation involves the understanding and acceptance of the concept of reincarnation. So consequently, as a very wise woman and great contributor to mankind pointed out, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, HPB, when she wrote a couple of books, one was called Isis Unveiled and the other was called The Secret Doctrine, she wrote about how we live many lives and we merely clothe ourselves in the clothing of that lifetime, but we through our force of evolution and through our will, we park ourselves in a certain vessel. We live a life, we do what we need to do, and then we leave again. And this is the cycle called rebirth, or the cycle of reincarnation.
And you see this in modern day culture many times with young children who are born with what seems at like inherent geniuses. Or, you know, you've been seeing a lot on YouTube these days, these young kids who are explaining the economy, they're explaining the meaning of life, they're explaining, they are playing very difficult musical pieces on the piano. So it is almost as if these individuals are born with hangovers from a previous time that they spent their whole life practicing.
Yeah, I mean, we have the story of Mozart playing the piano at four brilliantly and composing at four. We have all these kids now showing up on YouTube who are absolutely brilliantly gifted.
Well, I bless you, Jeff.
Excuse me.
I think that these examples are proof in themselves about iterations. But let's get back to the Master Saint Germain, and so. This Master Saint Germain, he had some things to say about gold, did he not?
Well, let's read a little something that he wrote about in the 30s, and he wrote this about gold and what it is. And this will give us interesting food for thought. Our agenda is not to tell you what to think. Our agenda is to give you food for thought and for you to noodle on it, or as one of my teachers would call, brood upon it.
Or what is commonly called discrimination.
There you go. So gold was a common commodity in this age, as in all golden ages, because its natural emanation is a purifying, balancing, and vitalizing energy or force. It is placed within the earth by the lords of creation, those great beings of light and love, who create and direct worlds, systems of worlds, and the evolutions of the beings upon them. The outer mind or intellectual knowledge of humanity holds within it little, very little, understanding of the real purpose for which gold exists on this planet. It grows within the earth like a plant, and though it is constantly pouring a purifying, vitalizing, and balancing current of energy into the very ground we walk upon, as well as into the growth of nature and the atmosphere we breathe, gold is placed upon the planet for a variety of uses, two of its most trivial and unimportant ones being that of using gold as a means of exchange and for ornamentation. The far greater activity and purpose of it within and upon the earth is the release of its own inherent quality and energy to purify, vitalize, and balance the atomic structure of the world. The scientific world today has no inkling as yet of this activity. However, it serves the same purpose to our earth that radiators do to our homes. Gold is one of the most important ways by which the energy from our sun is supplied to the interior of the earth, and a balance of activities maintained. As a conveyor of this energy, it acts as a transformer to pass the sun's force into the physical substance of our world, as well as to the life evolving upon it. The energy within gold is really the radiant electronic force from the sun, acting in a lower octave. Gold is sometimes called a precipitated sun ray. It's interesting. As the energy within gold is of an extremely high vibratory rate, it can only act upon the finer and more subtle expressions of life through absorption. In all golden ages, this metal comes into plentiful and common use by the mass of the people, and whenever such a condition occurs, the spiritual development of the people reaches a very high state. This is one of the inspirations behind our doing this work on retooling, bringing you into an alignment with your higher spiritual state, your higher reference point, if you will. In these ages, in these golden ages, gold is never hoarded, but instead is widely distributed into the use of the mass, who absorbing its purifying energy are themselves raised into greater perfection. Such is the right use of gold. And when this law is consciously understood and obeyed, the individual may draw any quantity he desires to himself by the use of that law. Because of the gold deposits in all mountain areas, one finds health and vigor in life upon the mountains that he cannot find in any other place on the earth's surface. No one ever heard of detrimental effects coming to those who constantly handle pure gold. While in its pure state, it is soft and wears away easily, still that very quality is the fulfilling of this purpose of which I have just spoken. The more advanced of these people produced much gold by precipitation directly from the universe. The domes of many buildings were covered with sheets of pure gold and the interiors decorated with brilliant jewels in curious yet marvelous designs. The jewels themselves were also precipitated direct from the one eternal substance. This is pretty interesting food for thought, and it also gives us a different perspective on why we view gold as so important, and yet it also brings us back into self-reliance, the use of, the owning, the wearing, and the collaborative use of gold.
I think it's interesting because it breaks things up into two separate camps. So if you're thinking about gold from a spiritual perspective and you take this into consideration, there's a much more abstract reason that cannot be proven by science. And science is such a concrete, objective, limited form of study that really limits us to the spiritual realm of what is. And so I think it's interesting that you bring this up, and what is your viewpoint about science and how it relates to a concept like this?
Great question. I suspect as we look back in terms of, let's chat a little about medicine and about the evolution of medicine. There was a thought, a belief hundreds of years ago that a woman would have a littler woman inside her, who would have a littler woman inside her, who would have a littler woman inside her, the Russian dolls, the Russian stacking dolls. And so consequently, when they had the audacity at that time, because at that time it was considered sacrilegious to dissect bodies, but when they actually went in there, they actually saw and discovered that women did not have little people in them so much as they had a different sense of procreation, if you will. And so consequently, the medical community and science in general had historically, science and religion and God and the church were one. Then there was a schism between the two of them. And now the quantum physicists are now coming back and they're starting to get that there is something more to the limited perspective of science on where we're going. So my objective or my observation is that science in the future will be far broader in its scope and far more capable of proving that which the ancients, which these wise sages, have been talking about all along.
Well, science is now being able to see and prove and show that the human body is in fact surrounded by a subtle body or many subtle bodies of energy, and that each individual is surrounded by these subtle bodies. And so this type of scientific thought or this scientific theory has never existed before in our civilization. We don't really know if it has in previous civilizations lost, but in our civilization now, that's proof of what you've just said, because these are things that were considered crack pottery, witchcraft. People who did energy work even 10, 20 years ago were labeled as weirdos, crazies, hippies, whatever. There's been many different names for those people. But now science is actually being able to verify this type of work and show that these types of energies around our body exist. So I guess my point is that as it pertains to gold and this very esoteric meaning that you've just read about it, who's to say that science won't be proving that soon as well?
That's where we're going. That is absolutely where we're going. We're also coming up with scientists that are not prepared to accept the old way. There's some very wise kids coming out, wise kids being born, reiterated again, if you will, or reincarnated, with a genius that is absolutely remarkable. And in one of the courses that I've taught in university, I see a lot of these absolutely brilliant young individuals who are 19, 20, 21, 2, and 3, who have the tenacity of saying, I don't believe what conventional science tells me because I think historically it has been wrong. So they have the audacity to question and not to take it as a given, because God knows we are in a place where mass media, mainstream media, are desperate to have everybody think in a certain way in order that they may keep them under wraps, if you will.
Control the masses, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Did we chat about sheeple last week, possibly?
Of course,
yeah.
We did.
There we go. And consequently, the venue that would suggest sheeple are those that we can manipulate via fear and via the next. And now, this is perhaps a good segue to wander into what we chatted a little about and what we prefaced by. We're going to chat about the NSA and about privacy and about security and about all kinds of things that we are now in a new age of technology, and we are now in a new age where we would have, I suspect, our rights violated by the very people that suggest they're trying to protect us.
Well, this is a really big topic, and it's been a big topic since 2007 when Facebook really blew up and people found out that Facebook was using third parties, third-party companies or programmers that had full access to people's private information. And so after that point, the concept of privacy, internet privacy, really blew up. And what we're seeing now is this big resurgence in the question of why is privacy important? Is privacy important? What does it mean in an age where our information is used on a regular basis? I mean, how many times do you enter in your phone number and your email address and your home address when you want to order something online? How many times are you giving this information out? What does privacy mean? Is it important? What do you think?
Well, it opens up an enormous amount of doors, and it opens up an article that I've just recently read on the NSA and how and what they do in order to facilitate our protection and where we're going in that. And I think it is a bit down a rabbit hole, because I think there is a certain aspect or a certain meme that has been propagated upon mankind that says this: if you have nothing to hide, who cares? Why should we not be able to go in and see exactly what you are doing? So it effectively says, let's live in a glass house.
But that statement is subjective, because what I think is something to hide is not the same as what Sally thinks is something to hide. It's not the same. You know, everyone has different viewpoints of what is right and wrong. And if we live in a world that's ruled by free will, my question then becomes, how is our free will, how is it imposed upon through lack of privacy?
Well, and that's another thing that sort of steps into how the lecture that I did some time ago is how you close down an open society. And it's the 10 steps of how you close down an open society. And it is a bit frightening, because I remember when I printed this up and shared it at the university, how all the secretaries in the in the in the engineering room. They all read it. They all passed it out and read it because I had this for material.
But I think the frightening part is that as you read it, you're like, check, check.
That's exactly.
So are you going to go through this list and read it to us, please?
Well, let's do that. Let's wander through. Now this came about from an article that was written about freedoms and privacy and also how governments. There's a whole evolution of a nation state or the people's state, right? And there's a nuance in here that gets a little frightening, and that aspect started with this article or this attention on pre-World War II in Germany. Okay, so governments all over the world employ these steps, and generally speaking, fear is how people are controlled. Okay. So that one of the steps, or let's just call it number one, is invoke an internal and external threat.
Which what we've seen that happen in the United States after September 11th, so they invoked a very invisible, hard to see external threat, which was at first Muslim terrorists, and then that kind of bled into all terrorists. And now what we're seeing is that there's all these terrorists inside of the United States, right? So that's that. Has check mark beside that one.
Oh, big time. And what did Hitler do? Hitler and the Nazi Party do? What did they do? They vilified the Jews. And they vilified every non-Aryan. So they vilified the Jews and they vilified the blacks and they vilified the browns and they vilified anybody.
And then they vilified the Germans who were protecting any
there
of those people.
There you go. And you play this. So we're now, you know, the internal and external threat right now is terrorism. And they are spending, I would venture, hundreds, maybe even more than hundreds of billions of dollars on this. But the military-industrial complex, that phrase was coined by good old Eisenhower back in the day, I think they've got to the point now where they're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on terrorism, on protecting terrorists. We thought when the Berlin Wall fell that the Cold War would end and consequently we could get back to normal. But in fact, it hasn't at all.
But how I think that we are back to normal, because when your entire economy is based on militarization and war, and that's how you make money, then that threat needs to constantly exist in order for you to sustain your economy.
And that's the role of sheeple and fear in sheeple. Let's make everybody terrified for their well-being, and let's hand over the responsibility of their well-being to somebody outside of themselves. Let's make people dependent on the state to protect them, which is terrifying in and of itself. And it is, in fact, Orwellian, is it not?
Mm.
Now, step number two is one of the things that Hitler did, right? Establish secret prisons for torture. What would that be called? Oh, I don't know.
Gitmo.
There you go.
Guantanamo Bay.
Right. And it affects
us. Obama said he would close, and he never closed.
He has not closed it yet, has he? And it affects us directly, because what it does is, it establishes fear where people are afraid to speak up. They're afraid to actually stand up and be counted because they might disappear one day. The Chinese have done it. The Chinese, they get dissidents any time that are speaking out against the way that they run their country. These guys just disappeared. Or, as some affiliates of ours would call, they get suicided.
That's right. And you know, now with the drone attacks, so with the use of drones, there's not even a human being that's an assassin that's in charge, or a prison guard that's in charge of that. These types of actions can be taken out from a control station, kind of like in the Hunger Games, where you've got these people around some buttons and they're controlling the fate of other people who live halfway across the country.
An interesting meme in that movie that we will cover soon as well. Kind of frightening.
You have to go see it.
Yeah. So the step number three is develop a paramilitary force. Okay. So Hitler established the SS and the Gestapo as his secret force. What have they done now?
Well, let's dive into the NSA, shall we?
Well, the NSA and the Homeland Security and the purchasing of all kinds of weapons. Did you know, and this is now common knowledge, that the Homeland Security has purchased, at this point in time when this was developed, they purchased 450 million hollow point bullets.
What are hollow point bullets? I'm sorry, I'm not up on my artillery.
There you go. So a straight bullet, a pointy piece of metal, is likely to pass through you if it doesn't rip apart or tear any major arteries or bones. But a hollow point bullet is made to explore, expand when it enters into your system. So they are far more deadly.
So there's no chance of survival.
Far less chance, absolutely. Less but chance. Homeland Security is supposed to, get a load of this, it's supposed to keep the homeland safe. And what they're doing is arming themselves. I don't know. The skeptic in me would think maybe Homeland Security is there to protect the government, because pretty soon we're going to have a compromise between what the government thinks is in our best interest and what we know is in our best interest. Brings us back to retooling by being discerning and retooling by being self-reliant.
Well, I retract my initial statement about the NSA, and I will say instead the militarization of police forces would fit under this heading, because we see what's happened all over the United States and even in the airports, where you've got individuals who are – they're basically dressed like SWAT teams, right? So you've got – and there's been lots and lots of money poured into local police stations. And it's not even proportionate to what crime rates are. It's more of a militarization of local police stations. And an example would be what happened in Toronto during the G20 a couple of years ago.
Boston Marathon, too, just a little while ago. One of the Iraqi war guys was on a blog talker and doing something, and he just said all of that equipment was in Iraq.
That's right. I remember
and they
that.
Just painted it blue. They painted it a different color. Yeah. They're using all the same equipment, all the same material. And what's happening is the military industrial complex is selling all of this equipment so they can develop a paramilitary force inside the states.
That's right.
To control the masses, which, again, gives me great consternation.
Well, because according to the Constitution, the United States military cannot in the borders of the United States. And so how do you get around that?
Right. Exactly. That's, again, that part of the fabric of this makes us question what's going on. Okay, that was step number three. Step number four, get a load of this, ladies and gentlemen.
Here's where we are.
Surveil ordinary citizens.
So let's spend some time here for a bit.
Oh, my.
So we've got Snowden, let's start with Snowden. He's a computer programming guy. He's working for the government. He's working for the NSA. He steals some PowerPoints, and then he gives it to the New York Times and the Guardian. Is that how it went down? He actually gave it to these outlets, and they got permission. And this is in the record, so you can go out and figure this out. But the news outlets got permission from the government to publish it before they published it. And then, after they got permission and published it, then the government proceeded to
chase them out of the country.
Call this individual a terrorist for stealing classified information and whatever you want to call it. But so now that we've got this. The American people find out that the NSA has been listening to phone calls, or not maybe listening to it, but collecting all of the phone calls, collecting where we're calling.
Yeah, I would doubt very highly that they would be collecting it without listening to it. They now have the computer power. The technology is there that they can absolutely have computers listen to anything and everything, and all they have to do is program it in. So while they say, well, we may not be, I think that's just a ruse.
So whether or not they're actually listening to it, the fact of the matter is that they have all of this information stored in these large storage facilities in Utah. Okay, so and it's they call it metadata is what they call it. That's the terminology for this data. So the NSA collects all of this metadata, and it's stored in these huge servers and these huge facilities that have been there for a very long time. So this has been in play for a while.
Yeah.
And now the American people find out about it, and they begin to get upset. And you have
governments of the world got upset. They did this to the Germans, and they did it to the Italians and the Spanish. I mean, they were surveilling all kinds of people.
So let me just really quickly read what happened when this scandal first broke and how President Obama reacted to it. So President Obama and I will tweet this link in a minute, but President Obama here's an answer to the question. Mr. President, could you please react to the reports of secret government surveillance of phones and the internet? And can you also assure Americans that the government, your government, doesn't have some massive secret database of all their personal online information and activity? His response to that, well, part of his response to that question was actually a very long response, but here's some excerpts from his response. President Obama said, when it comes to telephone calls, nobody is listening to your telephone calls. That's not what this program's about. As was indicated, what the intelligence community is doing is looking at phone numbers and durations of calls. They're not looking at people's names, and they're not looking at content. But by sifting through this so-called metadata, they may identify potential leads with respect to folks who might engage in terrorism. He finished up this statement by saying, but I think it's important to recognize that you can't have 100% security and also then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience. You know, we're going to have to make some choices as a society. So, Jeff, what choices as a society do you have when the information, your personal information, your private conversation are already stored?
Well, I think let's wander down a rabbit hole here. Let's discuss an iteration of how they can surveil you, and then how they may choose to combine information on you to make it look like you're a terrorist to get you out of the way, or make you look like you are subversive to their rule. And one of the things that the Chinese do is they just do it so heavy-handedly, is somebody stands up and goes, I think the Chinese government is doing nasty things, and all of a sudden they're whisked away.
They get suicided.
Yes, two shots to the head. Bob killed himself. He shot himself twice in the head. So the context of surveilling ordinary citizens is an episode of the demise of an open society, and it gets ugly, and it gets ugly in a place that gives us great pause, because the thought of having any of your statements taken out of context is quite a vile thought, and it gives you great it gives me great discomfort and indigestion to think that with all this data they could compile something against you that was so out of context that it would be very easy for them to justify throwing you into prison, which is not unlike the paparazzi or whatever. When somebody is doing something, there's everyday regular gossip. Absolutely correct. And how vile and how compromising that is. So we work under the ruse that they surveil everything to keep you safe. Well, I don't know. I mean, if everybody said no, thank you, and one of the things that happened in the source of my research, okay, the cross-hatching of data is so mind-bogglingly extensive that the NSA has only to compromise a few carriers of the phone records or a few carriers of the data of the emails and the like, because they just go to A, B, and C. They never mind the rest of the alphabet, because A, B, and C, they share everybody with all the other carriers. So there's just this cross-hatching of data where they only need to go and get a few people to say, okay, we'll let you back into this information, and they have all of it, okay? So the NSA's capacity to track locations are so staggering, because based on Snowden's docs that he exposed, they indicate that the agent is able to render most efforts at communication safety completely futile. So one of the things that I would venture that Snowden is not a traitor so much as he is somebody who's turning the lights on and exposing this kind of nonsense.
It's really questionable, that statement, personally, because I find it curious that all of the documents weren't released. Only bits and pieces of the documents weren't released, and nobody has access to them except for this individual called Glenn Greenwald and this other individual called Laura Poitras, who are supposed radical journalists who are now living in Brazil, and they have access to all of these files, but they're basically making it into a business now, where they're selling parts and pieces of all of this information that supposedly Edward Snowden stole or took, with the supposed intention of disseminating all this information. So it's not really like a WikiLeaks where WikiLeaks will put up everything on the website and you get to sift through it yourself. This is a different type of whistleblowing, and I have my fingers in quotations around whistleblowing because generally when someone whistleblows, they let it all out. And so this is kind of a different, this is a horse of a different color.
So what are you saying?
What am I saying? I'm saying that...
It's suspicious.
I'm saying that it stinks.
Okay. It is suspicious. Okay. Fair comment. I get and understand that. And again, part of what we would like to do and part of what our intention is to turn the lights on so people can make up their own minds as opposed to snowing them under or facilitating information dissemination in such a fashion that gives them enough information to be dangerous but not enough to make sound conclusions.
Right? Or punditry where, you know, we are yelling opinions and claiming that they're right and the listener should absolutely agree or they're crazy right wing or left wing or whatever the other.
Yeah, very good point. Because I think one of the things that we are often subjected to is the expertise of anybody, and the expertise of many people is relied upon. We look for experts in whatever various fields are. And there's a fine line between having a PhD, the interesting irony, the expert of Dr. Phil, right? I'm sure Dr. Phil has a PhD in something like biology, but he's I'm not sure whether that's the case, but I do know that Dr. Laura, who years ago was a talk show, she had her PhD in something that had nothing to do with psychology or nothing to do with anything, but she was an expert because she had a doctorate behind her name, right?
I'm really sorry, but I must admit that Dr. Phil is one of my guilty pleasures.
I see. Okay, well, but, nonetheless, it does, but again, where I was going with this was, merely because you are competent or you are brilliantly conversant in stuff doesn't necessarily mean you're illegitimate because you don't have a PhD. And one of the articles I was reading the other day was about a conflict of opinion between two individuals, and the PhD was trash-talking the guy merely because he didn't have a PhD, and the journalist was coming back with incredibly sound arguments and sound scenarios saying, show me where the illegitimacy of your declaration is and I will go and investigate. Did you check your facts? And he said, well, show me which facts you're taking exception to. So one of the things that's happening more and more with the advent of the internet and with access to the information is we can expertise ourselves without
formalized education.
Without formalized education, we can actually expertise ourselves by our own hand, by our own volition.
Well, getting back to this concept of privacy, I want to read an excerpt from a paper that I found in the Harvard Law Review by a woman called Julie E. Cohen, and it's talking about privacy, and I want to get your opinion on this concept. A commercial culture that sees privacy as threatening particular practices of knowledge production will register privacy regulation as a threat. But a society that values innovation ignores privacy at its peril, for privacy also shelters the processes of play and experimentation from which innovation emerges. In short, privacy incursions harm individuals, but not only individuals. Privacy incursions in the name of progress, innovation, and ordered liberty jeopardize the continuing vitality of the political and intellectual culture that we say we value.
Mm. Well, it steps back. I mean, what leaps out of that for me at this instant is the government is not out for your own good. The government is infiltrating these various groups, surveilling ordinary citizens. And I would think the whole nonsense of keeping you safe is something that is desperately questionable. I think they have an agenda that is far bigger than keeping you safe.
So then what do we do? Do we get offline? Do we stop using Facebook? Do we stop using Twitter? Do we stop emailing? What's the solution for those of us who actually value our own privacy, and we also believe that we are being violated? And what about even for the people who believe that the government isn't serving us at all and they're working against all of the rights and against the concept of having free will? What's the solution?
Well, I mean, I think it all falls back to one of the aspects of good government is that it is government, as good old Abe Lincoln said, it is government for the people, by the people, with the people, right? I mean, we have a government that is our agents, as opposed to us being at the behest of the government's directives. And I think there will be, my scenario is this, I think there will be a point in time where people just say no more, enough. There will be a point in time where people's agendas will be so transparent that they will say, I'm not prepared to believe the lie that you're in order, the lie that you are projecting in order to facilitate control over me. I'm not prepared to be a sheeple.
Well, I get what you're saying in terms of participation. So there's an aspect of participation in government, voting out those individuals who are doing their jobs poorly, which in one aspect makes complete sense. But in another aspect, when we are living in a society where many people have to maintain more than one job to survive and to pay their bills and to take care of their family, and where we talked about this in the last show, where it's no longer a situation where you can have one income and sustain your household and have one parent working and have one parent home with the family to learn this stuff and then decide together how to participate. We live in a society now where people literally feel like they have no time. So participation becomes kind of people's response to participation might be more of, I don't think I can do that. But what about on the personal level? I think that on the personal level, there has to be a responsibility. People need to take responsibility for how they view privacy. How does privacy play out in your private life? Are you minding other people's business? Are you minding your own business? Are you playing into this culture of gossip?
Again, another very germane topic. I think we have a culture and we have a society that has fallen into the place of what's in it for me and what do I get out of it. And we have a scenario where the government is doing the very same thing by suggesting that their best interests are the people's best interests. And we're seeing a huge divergence of interest in that regard. And so it brings us back to self-reliance and self-dependence and discrimination and also being able to recognize that we are all one. It's an unfortunate declaration, and it sounds a bit like a cliche.
I don't think it's an unfortunate declaration at all.
Well, there you go. I mean, good point. It is something that should not be lost on us.
I think that some people are just not conscious enough to realize that. They're just not in a place in their personal development to understand that as a concept. But I think that many people do understand that we are all one, that we are all on the same journey, on the same path towards the same destination.
Well, let's trust that that's the case. And let's trust that that is the rising tide that brings everybody into the same understanding, which we when you talk to the Iranians and when you talk to the Israelis and when you talk to even the Iraqis, their whole position is our governments may be doing stuff, but that's not what the people want or care about or or choose. So consequently, what governments are representing on behalf of their people may not necessarily be the case. And now what we're in this weird place where what the American government is not, definitively not acting in the best interests of their citizens. We're only on step number 4 here, too.
Well, obviously, this we're going to have to go back into this and continue this. And this topic of privacy is not a small topic because it's at the top of everyone's mind right now, considering what's going on in popular culture, in our governments, in society. But before we wrap up this portion of the show, I just want to read a quote, and it's a very famous quote, and it's this. Those who surrender freedom for security will not have, nor do they deserve, either one. And Benjamin Franklin said that, and I'm sure that he would be turning over in his grave in response to what President Obama's response to this breach of security and personal privacy has,
the
reality of it.
What's the phrase? You go back in history and you see all kinds of stuff. and you see this stuff happening over and over and over again. It's time for people to wake up. It's time for people to take exception to this stuff. Now, it lends us to self-investigation, self-discovery, seeing what is rather than what you've been told to see, fighting against the memes, retooling so you are not a subscriber to the memes, getting more than one perspective, evaluating and integrating more perspectives into your perspective.
And also deprogramming and going with what feels right, because sometimes things don't feel right and we go with it anyway because that's what society is doing, that's what the Joneses are doing. And so there's that concept of going into yourself and learning what feels right for yourself as opposed to what you're told is right. So there's that as well.
That's right. Self-reliance, lower and higher, right?
And then there's discrimination, and I think that's exactly the same thing as discrimination, and that's something we'll talk about on one of our future shows as well.
We have a lot to talk about.
I know. Yeah. So I know we had an email from a listener, and I know that we wanted to dive into that before we end today.
Okay. I want to chat a little about some efforts that are being put forward in order to facilitate a change of this addresses the financial or the monetary system. It also addresses our civil liberties. It also addresses whistleblowers out there sort of talking about what's happening. And if we now dial it back into the financial perspective and how owning gold is beneficial, but also how the monetary system has been so compromised that there will be a point in time where it may systemically implode. We would like, on one hand, we'd like to see that happen because then it's the powers that be are trying to operate in order to control stuff, which lends me to another author named Robert Reich, who used to be the Secretary of Labor. And under Bill Clinton, who's now started an entire book called Inequality for All. However, I want to chat a little about the real world, as one of our listeners points out to it, and we want to talk about Karen Hughes and her documentation and her desire to turn on the lights. Okay, it's something that, you know, in all fairness, my conversantness is not nearly as high as I would like it to be, and I will continue to spend time and effort to be more conversant in it. But I do think it's individuals like this that go in and play a hand that says, been there, done that, I want to talk about it. And there's also a context in here that I want to be ever mindful of, and that is the difference between skepticism and cynicism. And the difference between skepticism and cynicism is skepticism is being mindful about what's being told to you and understanding the agenda of it. And cynicism is being so dismissive of anything that doesn't agree with you that you preclude yourself from paying attention to stuff that may be relevant. And one of the things that happens with the sheeple that we talk about is that when you present them with an idea that they view as contrary to their own, rather than investigate, they just take exception to it. And this is when the tweets just get weird and ugly, and they have no validity, or they have no girth, or they have no backing to it, which is further to a conversation we just had. Now, so now one of the other things that George has brought to the topic, and this is NASARA legislation, which is the National Economic Security and Reformation Act. Now, one of the things that I am skeptical about in terms of what is happening is the very premise that can you reform government within government? I am quite skeptical of that because I do think that it's inside a culture that is so compromised that it can't get out of its own way. So I really do think that there needs to be a destruction of the old system in order to start a new system, not unlike the metaphor of out of the ashes rises the phoenix. Because I do think that conventional government needs to implode upon itself. I do think the people need to have some kind of a, a passive, albeit not certainly not a military, but they need to have a passive resistance to the fact that the government is not acting in their own best interests. The government is acting. The government is not acting in the people's best interests. It's acting in its best interest. And I think, you know, a small vignette of this is when the Greeks started to go upside down and the Greek people started to say, well, we're not paying toll booths and we're not paying a whole bunch of tax. The government were powerless to do anything about it because they didn't have the manpower and they couldn't pay anybody in order to go and police it.
I think I heard just the other day that in Greece they have, and I might be wrong on the exact number, but almost 60% unemployment in Greece right now.
You know, there's a meme that suggests the government will look out for you. And I don't think the government's looking out for you. I think they're looking out for themselves. But there is, again, it's you're being driven to a cliff where you're saying, I have to be self-reliant. And one of the things that will happen sooner or later is that mankind, the awake mankind, will recognize that the government is not out to look after you. And I think that's a meme because the government says then uses that to control you. Now, a couple of things that have come out I wanted to share with you because certainly we're back into deposit confiscation, which we will follow up as
and
well.
And this is called bail-ins. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. But I want to go back to one of the things that Robert Reich has done on his website, and he's talked about the website is called inequalityforall.com.
And I will tweet that right now. So if you want to follow us on Twitter, our Twitter name is @retoolingdot.org.
Okay, and so here's the fact. There's $2.13 an hour versus $3 million an hour. Okay, that's an interesting fact. Okay, a single top income could buy housing for every homeless person in the U.S. This is stuff from this website. It's quite remarkable. The poorest 47% of Americans have no wealth. There's some wealth distribution, okay? And the U.S. is nearly the most wealth unequal country in the entire world. In the entire world. That's mind-boggling. A can of soup for a black or Hispanic woman in terms of the U.S. and a mansion and a yacht for the businessman. The discrepancy is outrageous. And this guy was the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, and he has done some interesting stuff. He's done some very interesting stuff. Anyway, with that, we trust that we've covered some. We only got through four steps to close an open society, so I think we may need to readdress that. We may wish to revisit some of this stuff. We would look forward to your comments and input. And we also
yes, you can reach us via our website. Our website is retooling.org. There's a contact page there. There's also all of our archived shows. You can get straight links from there. You can also follow us on Twitter, as I've mentioned already today. And you can be an active participant in our show and definitely get in contact with us. And we have a blog too. So we will be blogging our show topics and various other topics that we feel like writing about.
We started off with gold. We fall into security and privacy and NSA. We always fall back on self-reliance. We try to propagate turning the lights on so you can see what is rather than what somebody may want you to see. We play with gold and how it all unfolds. Gold, by the way, which we will eventually come back to, is traveling with brilliant velocity into China right now. Do they know something that we don't know? And consequently, we want to leave you with the opportunity to think about this, and we also want to leave you with the gratitude of thank you for allowing us to be of service.
Have a glorious day.